Dear friends, I am afraid that the most that can be said of life is that it is a rude and uncertain enterprise. And so it is not surprising that men are forever inventing and imagining more stately mansions for their dwelling. To live is to dream. From Plato's Philosopher's Republic to the utopian islands of Sir Thomas More to our contemporary vision of a more abundant community capsuled in the president's image of the great society. The literature of the world and our political thought and our philosophy has been enriched by many a vision splendid. Now, is there any basis in fact for these happy hopes? Or are they sheer fantasy? Are they a testimony to nothing more than man's inventive abilities? Our ability to fabricate new and more ingenious illusions? Or are they a tribute to the reach and the range of our vision? By way of answer, I would place before you this morning the two utopian visions presented to us in our Bible, Paradise and the Promised Land. And I would ask you to notice how differently the Bible treats each. In the beginning, there was the Garden of Eden, a utopia, a green place of many pleasures, a paradise where man's every want and need was amply and effortlessly satisfied. And then the serpent beguiled Eve, and Eve coaxed Adam, and they ate of the forbidden fruit, and they were exiled from paradise. And not only were they banished from this garden, but the verdict was irrevocable. The Bible tells us that God placed an angelic sentry with brandished sword at the gate that none might ever re-enter. The gates of paradise are locked shut. For all practical purposes, it is as if the garden had never been. Now, of course, there was no Garden of Eden. The story is constructed out of myth, out of the language of legend. And yet it is drawn out of the living stuff of life. For what is Eden but our own dimly remembered secure delights in childhood? What is Eden but innocence outgrown that can never be recaptured? Eden is all that is implicit in the sigh with which we repeat Mr. Shaw's well-known phrase that youth is so good that it is too bad that it is wasted on the young. We are all born into Eden, or so it seems in retrospect, and we grow, inevitably so. And as we grow, we eat, as did Adam and Eve of the tree of knowledge, and our eyes are opened, and we see death, and we notice pain, and we note the mysterious mathematics of life, how some die young, that the good are not always rewarded. We are tormented. We exile ourselves from Eden. And the older we are and the more experienced, the less snugly and comfortably life fits us. We see the child pulling the wings from the living butterfly, and we see the child man tormenting his weaker neighbor. We cannot stop growth. We cannot prevent being banished from the nursery. And so we are pushed out into the real world, and the gates of paradise are locked tight, and we can never return. Paradise is a place of no return, except in the hallucinations of madness. We must live in the world as it is, for the nursery world, the fairy tale world, where everyone lives happily ever after, is a world built and based solely on our innocence and on our ignorance. Lohaya, ולא נברא. There never was such a life. Now what does the Bible mean to teach us by this image of a paradise locked? Simply this, that there is no fairy godfather, that there is no good wish witch of the East, that all of our Cinderella stories are nothing more than a projection of our own longings, insubstantial, unreal. Do not depend in your lives on some bolt of lightning out of the blue, on some miracle. Life must be lived within the contexts of our daily routine. We cannot change our skin. We cannot exchange our sex. We cannot change the facts of our birth. We cannot multiply the reach of our talent. We must learn to live with the world as it is. We must learn to live with ourselves as we are. Now it is natural to dream. Every man constructs these daydreams, these fancies based on his nursery experience. Yet it is not wise to live with our head there high in the fairy tale heavens, so high that each day is a daily despair, that each experience plunges us deeper into remorse, for the real world does not have streets that are paved with gold. Its streets are littered. In the real world, all people are not like our parents, sweet and loving and reasonable. People are quixotic. Each has his own disposition. Each has his own needs. The real world is our world. We ought not to have built for ourselves a world of such fine fancy that it destroys our ability to enjoy that which we really have. All the color and the excitement, the love, and the relationships which can be ours here and now in this real life. The rabbis capsuled this wisdom in the phrase, Ashrei Ha'ish Someach Bechelko. The secret of happiness is man's ability to accept his own circumstance. You do not need to be a Nobel laureate to make a contribution to the ongoing development and progress of man. You do so daily in your business as you conduct yourself with honor. You do so daily as your home, as your love and your teaching raises children straight and strong, sturdy and steadfast. You do so in your civic undertakings where the extending of your help, the granting and the giving of time and of effort lends strength to the needs of a city. Now we all have fantasies. We all listen to what Dr. Freud once called the lullabies of heaven. Those wonderful, ethereal melodies which come to us from a never-never land, where all the limitations of this life are somehow made complete. Where all the loneliness of this life is somehow forgiven in thunderous applause. Where all the failures and frustrations of this life turn into a golden success. We all dream. To live is to dream. But we cannot live in our dreams. Dreaming, we destroy the happiness that can be ours. For our dreams place our ambitions so high. Our dreams cause us to live by a standard which we cannot attain, and they take from us the ability to enjoy that which truly can be ours. You do not have to sit in the seats of power in order to affect the course of your life. You don't have to have amassed all wealth to have become the president of a giant corporation in order to be secure. And yet, if you are nagged by this fantasy, if it gives you no peace, you may have enough, a sufficiency and then some, and know only unhappiness. You do not need the beauty of a Venus in order to be loved or to know love. For Beauty is that inner grace and charm, which is personality, which is a human being at peace with himself or herself. It is not some inherited external form. And yet if you are caught up with some adolescent conjuration of beauty, what peace can be yours? What love can be yours? Or whatever grace is yours by birth will never be enough. We must learn to live with the world that is ours. The beginning of wisdom, the beginning of maturity, is our acceptance of our banishment from paradise and our willingness to live in this world, a world of death and of pain, a world in which men are mortal and fallible, a world in which men can be cynical and callous one to another. The beginning of wisdom is a willingness to live in this world without regret, to accept it for what it is, and to seek to make it an even better place. The gates of paradise are locked. The Greek word utopia means simply no place. There is no paradise. Lo haya, lo nivra. If paradise is locked tight, the gates of the promised land are always open. At the beginning of our history, God covenanted with Abraham, "Lift up your eyes and look about this place. For all the land which thou seest, to thee I will give it, and to thy seed after thee, as an eternal inheritance." The focus of our long history is simply this: the desire to be on the land, to possess the land, and to build upon it a promise equal to the blessing. The patriarchs came to the Holy Land, and they pastured their flocks there, and they camped there. And they left the land only when they were driven off by drought or by famine, the need to seek pasture elsewhere. But always they returned. And then we were taken off the land again by our enslavement in Egypt, and we remained deprived of the land for many centuries. And then came the Passover, and God's deliverance from bondage. And then came Moses, and he led the people back to the very gates of promise. And so it has always been in our history. As it was under Joshua, we have pioneered the land. As it was under the judges and under the kings, we built high its cities. We tilled its farms and its vineyards. We understood and enjoyed its wealth. And there were times when the vicissitudes of history turned against us, and we were driven off the land. But always we kept close the dream. Always the land beckoned. And as in our own generation, it reached out to us across the centuries and drew us back. And we renewed the land, and we rebuilt it. Now, there are some, the cynics, who say that over the archway of birth, there ought to be inscribed the phrase, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." Our Bible insists, through the vision of the promised land, that life is something more than a barren, difficult enterprise. There are hopes that do come true. There are dreams that can be realized. It may take 40 years of wilderness wandering to come to the promised land. It may take centuries of human undertaking to build a high civilization. But the land is there. The civilization can be built. The promise can be found. How does our hope for a promised land differ from the fantasies of paradise? Paradise is ethereal. It is unreal. It is no place. The promised land is acreage. It is a fact of geography. It is within time and place. We dream of paradise, and we dream of immortality, something impossible to man. We dream of the promised land when we devote ourselves to the healing sciences and seek within the terms of mortality to increase man's ability, his strength, his ability to enjoy the years which are, by God's decision, his. We dream of paradise when we dream of a world of saintly people A world where everyone, in a sense, is created after our own image. We dream of the promised land, when we dream of building the welfare of the whole, when we establish justice, when we found righteousness within the social order. Paradise is an ethereal place. The promised land is this place. Now each of us has his own vision of a private promised land. We wish, we pray, we dream of a certain scope for our skills. We wish, we pray, we dream for a certain security for our family. We wish, we pray, we dream for a certain place, the respect of our community. And it is good to dream. And if we rein in these dreams within the realm of the possible, that can be achieved, even if it requires every ounce of energy, every devotion, sacrifice in our parts. Man is meant to dream. We are meant to have a vision splendid towards which we guide and direct and focus our every act. A grand dream ennobles life, but too grand a dream. A dream drawn from the world of fancy. Too grand a dream is an illness. It's a mania. It destroys life. It dooms our efforts before we undertake them. We become like the ancient Icarus of Greek legend. You remember the man who built himself crude wings of wax in order to fly to the sun, and how he rose a few miles off the earth, and then the heat of the atmosphere burned the wax, and he plunged headlong into the roiling sea. Our dreams need to be constructed of the stuff of life. They need to be within the reach of our talents, need to be within the facts of our circumstance. We cannot change the human being that we are. We cannot give ourselves talents we did not inherit. We cannot convert ourselves from one type of human being to another. All that we can do is to hone sharply the skills that are ours. All that we can do is to use the powers which are ours sufficiently. And these powers are sufficient to lead a good life, to contribute to our world, to know love, to no responsibility, and to discharge significant duty. The promised land is fact, not fancy. But the promised land is something more than mere fact. The promised land is more than conquest, more than another nation, more than success, more than the reaching of the top of the greasy pole. Our ancestors conquered the land. The promised land was theirs. They lived in its cities. They built high its palaces. They leveled its roads. They farmed its hillsides. And it was not the promised land for which they had dreamt. And the finest of the spirits of our ancestors, the prophets, came among them and said, "How have you despoiled this dream? How did you fail to understand that you must not only own the land, cultivate it, know its wealth, but it was your responsibility to build upon this land a society which was full of decency and dignity, of justice and of freedom? For yours is a promised land only insofar as it becomes a holy land, a land which reflects in its institutions, in its citizens, God's law, a divine way, a goodly life. You were too busy being busy with your business. You were too busy mining the wealth of the earth, taking the toll of trade, enjoying the profit of your crafts, eating the harvest of your fields. This is not the promise, the full promise of this land. Here was a land given to you for holy purpose, to love the good, to establish justice in the gates, to eradicate the injustice of class and of caste. And what did you do? What did you do? You became indulgent, and luxury made some of you into vultures, and indolence made others of you into grasshoppers. prosperity perverted you. And you changed this land into simply another place of dwelling for another of the many tribes of the Middle East. The promised land is not only success, the material success of which we dream, but a spiritual success. The attainment of the millennial vision of all men for a better world, a more decent life, a higher level of dignity and of opportunity for all. For what is success? What success is ours if we have what the world calls success, the tinsel? But in the process, we have tarnished our good name. We have exhausted and broken our health, and we have so drawn away from our families that they are alien to us. What is the virtue of success if it does not bring happiness? What is the virtue of the promised land if it is not established in freedom? What is the virtue of all of our undertaking if it does not bring good and goodness into life? Now let me apply this for a moment to our own present vision of the Holy Land. Most of us agree with our president and his image of the Great Society. What is this image but a contemporary vision of the promised land? And it is a realistic vision. Thank God our land is sufficiently abundant to provide for all. Thank God our machine is sufficiently intricate to provide for all. Thank God our surplus is sufficiently great to provide the education and the training and the leisure and the recreation and the decency, which is the birthright of every man. Poverty can be eradicated. Illiteracy can be erased. The ancient divisions of race and class can be overcome. The Great Society is a realizable dream. It falls in the category of the promised land. But is it enough? What will we have? What will we have if we erase poverty? If we erase and tear down the slums? If every man has opportunity, and every man exploits that opportunity in selfish purpose. Israel was never more prosperous as it was under the days of such kings as Omri and Ahab, and never more pained. For the people turned away from the God of their fathers. Wealth became a mirage which drew them on to ever greater gluttony and greed. Indolence led to idleness, leisure led to vice, and the great vision of promise led to the destruction of the people. And I look about myself at this gracious land of ours, a land which can imagine realistically for the first time to achieve the great society, and I wonder if we have the human capacity really to create the great society. We have declared war on poverty, thank God. Finally, war is to be used for a constructive purpose against the ugliest of facts of the human society. We have declared war on poverty. But how many among us have already declared themselves conscientious objectors in this war? How many among us want no part in this battle? There are the greedy, and there are many. They are those who say to us, we will not pay the taxes for the welfare of the whole. Let each man take care of himself. And many of our best citizens are among the greedy, among those who oppose each and every taxation, each and every welfare program. And there are the carefree, those who say, yes, hire a professional army. Marshal the social workers and the teachers of our land. Let them go in and tutor and enlighten and bring these people out of their darkness. For me, I want no part of it. I will not give a single hour of my time, my precious time, the time I so beautifully fritter away. I will not give an hour of my time to this undertaking. And there are the stunted people, the people who enjoy living with their medieval prejudices. who will not welcome a man of another background into their neighborhood, who will not hire a person of another color into responsibility. And there are the careless men, a generation which has gone to seed in its search for the thrill, for the sport, which seeks only indulgence, leisure, opportunity to enjoy itself, to live off the fatness of the land, but which will not return to the land which has given them all this, a single iota of it, of their own strength and wisdom. And I see all these people now, before the great battle has been won, even before it has been joined. And I ask myself if the ancient evils erased, we will indeed have the human stuff create to achieve decency within the great society. Woe unto them who are at ease in Zion. So the prophet Amos. And Amos told the people what I am telling you this morning, that they were of the promised land, but that the promise can slip easily from their grasp. Lamentation will yet be heard in the streets of Jerusalem unless you learn to hate the evil, you learn to love the good, you learn to establish justice in your gates, you learn to undertake the responsibilities of citizenship seriously, you learn to undertake the responsibilities of community with dignity, with a willingness to share broadly, to sacrifice. Paradise? There is no paradise. The promised land? We are almost there. It's just around the corner. A land flowing with milk and honey. A land whose cities reach to the very heavens. A land whose institutions are more generous and more gracious and more full of opportunity than any heretofore even conceived by man. The ancient utopian visions do not begin to approximate today's reality. Have we the stuff here? To live within the promised land. Can we secure it? Can we found it solidly? Can we reject its excess, the siren call of its richness, and remain dedicated human beings, devoted to the law, devoted to the good, devoted to God and God's way? This is our challenge and our hope.